Are there any questions? Otherwise, we will return to Steve. He has thoughts, further thoughts. Yes. I confirmed yellow. Yeah. Yellow team next week. So Steve Jacobson will continue with his talk. We'll have more table discussion and then final few moments for Q&A at this microphone. Here we go.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And in terms of making the presentation, 27 years of being a parish pastor, community, I didn't grow up in a church community, and I learned it in the church, and with such deep appreciation. When people were joining the church, I used to say, you know, this is California, it's Goleta, California. When we talk about community, if you're living in rural Midwest, you may have a community. So many people move here and don't. And to be blunt, people can move here, think it's wonderful, and then a tragedy happens to them. They know no one in town, and they're totally lost about how to, you know. And plus, they lose the opportunity to serve others when tragedy strikes. And to be in an intergenerational community and to see people die, to see children baptized, to see all this stuff happen decade after decade, to me, just became a very important part of my life. So I used some other examples from Guadalupe and Mecca, but I mean, I could talk for a long time about how I've been taught by my people in my congregation about spirituality, soul, wisdom, and all those good things. So I'm going to go on now. And so we've got two of the, to me, the sacred thirds. We've got one and two. So now this is the third third. Okay, so I'm going to, this is not a Rorschach test, but does anybody have a guess what this might be an illustration of? Right, 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. So I'm going to talk about where does faith lead us, where does our soul, I think, soul lead us. And in Genesis 41, great, great, great story of Joseph, the last third or so of Genesis, all about Joseph. And we meet Joseph as one of the sons of Jacob. And it becomes, he's a gifted young man, creates a lot of problems, but he's a great dream interpreter. So if you don't know the story, very simply, he is in prison, and Pharaoh's had this dream. None of Pharaoh's wise people can interpret this dream. What does it mean that he sees seven fat cows and seven very thin cows? So they bring Joseph up from his cell, and he interprets it to Pharaoh, and he says, you know, what this means is that the seven fat cows means there's going to be 7 years of plenty. But it's going to be followed by 7 years of scarcity, of drought, of difficulty. So now the reason why I'm telling this story is that here's how it goes after Pharaoh hears this story. Now therefore let Pharaoh select a man who is discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plenteous years. Let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and lay up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. For that food shall be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine that are to befall the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through the famine. So Joseph's given Pharaoh a suggestion. Joseph, a prisoner of a different ethnic group, and a different nationality, really, than Pharaoh. The proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find anyone else like this, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves at your command, as your command. Only with regard to the throne will I be greater than you." Back in the 90s, some doctoral work I did, and then I was really interested in the connection of spirituality and work, the Monday through Friday work, and did a lot of work around that. And I just started looking at Scripture again, with a different lens, just saying, well, what's the connection between spirituality and work. I came across this story, and it's had a profound effect on me. One thing that's interesting, the first time in the Bible anybody is talked about as having the Spirit of God in them, it's right here. Said by an Egyptian pharaoh, a foreigner, to Joseph, who is a prisoner in his in Pharaoh's empire. Joseph comes up, interprets the dream, gives a proposal what to do with the dream, and Pharaoh says, "Wow, you're smart. The Spirit of God must be in you. So I'm going to make you, you know, in charge of this." And Joseph takes that responsibility, and he successfully manages the Egyptian economy for 14 years. Not only by his successful management of the Egyptian economy are the Egyptians spared from famine, but the rest of the region has had famine too, so Egypt supplies food to the other countries. This is the story. And not only did that keep them from starvation, but it's an income stream for Egypt. So the point is, to me, I think, okay, Joseph basically has become like the minister of the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Interior. He's given a job not in his temple, but in government. And he's got to use his skills that God has given him to become an excellent bureaucrat. Really, truly. His successful managing of the Egyptian economy is a great blessing to the Egyptians and to other people in the world. And this hit me because I think, how often in the church, as I went to seminary and learned, did we say that the great vocation is to be a pastor? Or the greatest thing you can do is serve in the church? And I thought, what about Joseph? The gifts God gave him, he uses to manage an economy of one of the biggest countries in the world at the time, and to do great good with it. How often do we in church give thanks for all we talk about our public servants and the president and everything else, but really take seriously that most people's lives are lived not in the church, at church meetings, but out in the world, many people in government service, and that this is a very high vocation. This is a very high vocation. So Joseph, we could say, this is kind of stretching it a bit back to Genesis, but he had a personal religion, you know, that he was being raised in, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He had community insofar as his brothers. It was kind of a sketchy community, but eventually, through the friction, they learned to love, they forgive each other. So the friction kind of shows up and they get over it. But there's something good that happens out in the world because of his, shall we say, personal religion. The spirituality had an effect not only on him personally, the way it integrated him and gave him purpose, but it benefited other people. Now this one, I don't know if anybody could pick this one up real quick. The person up in the tree, if I can give you two facts, and you'll know, a lot of you will know who it is. Zacchaeus, right. Luke 19, probably every Sunday school curriculum among the stories often includes the story of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is up in a tree because he's short of stature. Jesus comes along and looks at him and, I'll read it here. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector, so he has a government job for Rome, and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry, come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I've ever defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost." It's often talked about as a great thing of forgiveness. Here's this collaborator with the Romans who's cheating people on taxes, and because Jesus connects with him, he's forgiven. But what's really interesting to me, as I was in this stage in my career when I was looking at these things, is that it doesn't say anything about the fact that he had to leave his job. Jesus doesn't say, "Stop working as a tax collector and come follow me." Jesus goes into Zacchaeus' house, and we don't know what the time lapse was between verse 7 and 8, It could have been a couple of hours. Zacchaeus is just there listening to Jesus in his presence, feeling his grace. And Zacchaeus comes to an ethical epiphany. And he's like, I'm ripping people off. This is not how I want to live. So I'm going to give, in fact, and I've got a lot more stuff than I need. I can give half of what I've got away. I can keep the other half. If I've been unethical to somebody, I can pay them back four times to really show I'm serious. But from my point of view, he did that and he kept his job. Again, it's somebody who is working for a foreign government and he's a tax collector, but now he's an ethical tax collector. I would rather have an ethical tax collector than one more minister sometimes. You know what I mean? I'm serious. I mean it. I mean, you know, if you're in that town that Zacchaeus is in and things move on, and in my town we have a tax collector who doesn't rip us off, who gives to the poor. That affects everybody in the community. What's also interesting is the word salvation. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this is the only time Jesus used the word salvation. And salvation has traditionally meant being saved from hell. But in the Hebrew meaning, it really means wholeness. It really means becoming whole. So Jesus says to Zacchaeus, you've become a whole person this day. And for me, the subtitle is, and you can keep your job, because now you have a proper perspective of how to use your job for yourself, but for other people as well. So again, that's a powerful thing to me about, like Joseph, Zacchaeus, these are people that, there are many people that Jesus says, come follow me, and they leave being fishermen. Matthew leaves being a tax collector. But in this case, what was right was that this person stay in government service, in we could almost call it business, but he's got a clear ethical sense of things. And Jesus says, wholeness has come, you're healed today. And you're going to go to work the next morning, but you're a different person, and your life is going to have meaning now. So Zacchaeus' salvation isn't just good for Zacchaeus, it's good for all the people that come into contact with him in his work as a tax collector. So what I'm getting to now is also reflected, I think, of a lot of us, if we've been involved in the Christian tradition, in mission trips and soup kitchens and homeless shelters, political action, medical care, hospitals, civil rights. It's when we have a personal religion that we find meaningful and authentic. We have community in which sometimes we have friction, but we also find we learn things that we wouldn't learn just on our own. And we have the sense of going out of ourselves, going farther. I can't help but show a little clip from On the Waterfront, the Marlon Brando movie from 1954. To me, when people say, you know, what's a great spiritual movie? What's a great Christian movie? On the Waterfront, to me. So in this great scene, there's the corrupt folks down working the docks that are being oppressed by corrupt union. And there's some people starting to maybe say this isn't right and to stand up to the union bosses that are corrupt. And one of them is Joey Doyle. And just before this happens, somebody has shoved Joey Doyle off the top of the ship and he's died. He's died as he hit the lower deck. So they call the priest, Carl Malden. Great. I think he might have gotten an Academy Award. I don't know, but I mean, it's great. So I just don't see this much anymore or done this well about, and now I'm speaking from the Christian perspective. This is always, to me, significant. Sorry.
I came down here to keep a promise. I gave K.O. my word that if he stood up to the mob, I'd stand up with him. All the way. And now K.O. Dugan is dead. He was one of those fellas who had the gift of standing up, but this time they fixed him. Oh, they fixed him for good this time. Unless it was an accident, like Big Mac says. Some people think the crucifixion only took place on Calvary. They better wise up. Taking Joey Doyle's life to stop him from testifying is a crucifixion. And dropping a sling on K.O. Dugan because he was ready to spill his guts tomorrow, that's a crucifixion. And every time the mob puts the pressure on a good man, tries to stop him from doing his duty as a citizen, it's a crucifixion. And anybody who sits around and lets it happen, keeps silent about something he knows has happened, shares the guilt of it just as much as the Roman soldier who pierced the flesh of our Lord to see if he was dead.
Come back to your church, Father!
Boys, this is my church! And if you don't think Christ is down here on the waterfront, you've got another guest coming.
Get out of the dark, Father!
Julio, don't do that.
Who signed you on, boy?
Let him finish.
Every morning, when the hiring boss blows his whistle, Jesus stands alongside you in the shape-up. He sees why some of you get picked and some of you get passed over. He sees the family men worrying about getting their rent and getting food in the house for the wife and the kids. He sees you selling your souls to the mob for a day's pay.
The next bum that throws something deals with me. I don't care. He's twice my size.
Now, what does Christ think of the easy money boys who do none of the work and take all of the gravy? And how does he feel about the fellas who wear $150 suits and diamond rings on you union dues and your kickback money? And how does he, who spoke up without fear against every evil, feel about your silence?
Tell him about that.
Just watch this. You see that?
You want to know what's wrong with our waterfront? It's the love of a lousy buck. It's making love of a buck, the cushy job, more important than the love of man. It's forgetting that every fella down here is your brother in Christ. But remember, Christ is always with you. Christ is in the shape up, he's in the hatch, he's in the youth, he's kneeling right here beside Dugan. And he's staying with all of you. If you do it to the least of mine, you do it to me. And what they did to Joey and what they did to Dugan, they're doing to you. And you. You. All of you. And only you. Only you, with God's help, have the power to knock them out for good.
Okay, K.O.
Amen.
All right, come on. Come on, let's go. Break it up. Let's go to work.
Edith, sure is Jackie. I'm sure Kale would wish you had.
Something? I've seen it a lot. Every time I see it, it just moves me. Other comments, but just seeing that?
I mean, it is, I'm so saddened that it is true to this day.
Sad that it's true to this day?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see that, and it's great drama, you know, but my soul is moved. And when I hear, it reminds me of, you know, in the Pope Francis's best moments, when Karl Malden is given his doc sermon, I feel like that's Jesus. That's why people maybe had a personal spirituality when they're coming to see Jesus, but after seeing him and watching what he did, they were shaken up. Mm-hmm. And they saw the world differently, you know. And I think at the best moments of the Christian community, it's there. And out there, working to face evil and injustice and all those powerful things. Agreed? Yeah. This won Best Picture in 1954. Marlon Brando, Best Actor. Leonard Bernstein did the score. It was one of his early things. And I just got to tell you, we did a couple months ago at La Casa, we did a special day for Carita, the artist. And Eva Marie Saint, who's in the movie, she and her husband, who was a TV producer, had done a film biography about Carita. We're up in, if you know La Casa, we're at the Center for Spiritual Renewal in the Terrace Room, and we got about 50 people. There was a really hot day, and so I'm kind of moderating. And then I sit down, and I look around. Behind me is sitting Eva Marie Saint. Mm-hmm. She's like in her early 90s, and she had come to La Casa to hear this Carita event. And I was like, wow, she kissed Marlon Brando in 1954, you know, as well as, you know, Cary Grant and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, and she was so gracious. It was just an honor, and beautiful woman. Anyway, so, but back to the point. You know, personal religion, really important. To me, I think community, whether it's Sangha or Koinonia or Uma, and this is Islam or whatever, or here, maybe community here. Those communities really help form us. And I want to end, and I'm sorry, I'll be here as long as you want, but I recognize you've got 10 of, and I want to just finish with one. I want to make a ending here. That I think, to me, personal religion, ideally, is part of somehow connected with community, also connected with service and justice. It doesn't have to be. For a lot of folks in America today, it's not. It's just personal religion. And community is kind of sketchy because it takes a lot of time. There's some friction there. And service, maybe once in a while I'm feeling inspired, maybe I'll go do something. But it's just, I mean, for me as a pastor for all those years, this is just the bread and butter of spiritual life. These three things, these are the three basic food groups. and they each play off each other. So I want to end with... an interfaith story, which is after 9/11, John and I and some others were involved in Interfaith Alliance of Santa Barbara, which is sponsoring the event here in a couple weeks. And so because of that, I'd gotten to know some of the Islamic community, and I'd already known a couple of the rabbis here in town. And I thought, you know what I'd like to do, because often we'd have these events, but the conversation was very polite, but it was hard to get very deep. And I thought, what if we got a group of people from the Jewish congregation, the Islamic community, and my congregation, and we just basically every other week for a year, we just had lunch together and see where it goes. So I got a grant through the Lilly Endowment to pay for the food, which made it kind of fun. Free lunch all the time. And so I met with the vice president of the Islamic Society, Hussam. You remember Hussam Musa? And he said, well, let me give you about six or eight people that might be good. I met with Rabbi Cohen, and he suggested about six or eight people, and I let my congregation know and some people. I wanted to keep it small enough to kind of create a little mini community. So first of all, I didn't know what would work. So we started at one of the Indian restaurants on State Street, because if you're a devout Muslim or a kosher Jewish person, you want to eat at a place where the meat is kosher or halal in Islam. And that Indian restaurant served meat that was halal and kosher. I didn't know Santa Barbara had any of that. The first time we were there in that restaurant, and it was hard floors, hard walls, and so it was hard to hear. And we had a couple tables kind of try to put them together. And I would introduce myself to some of the Islamic people, their names. I could not remember their names for the life of me. A lot of syllables that I'd never heard of, and it was, everybody's being polite. And so after it was all done, and it was nice, so one gentleman was there with a beard, Islamic guy, and I said, what's your name? And he said, it was Mukhtar Khan. I didn't remember it at that time. And I said, oh, so Mukhtar, I think I met your wife before. I think she's from Medina. Are you as well? And he said, well, yes, I was born there. But my father was from India. And I said, oh, wow, India, really? She goes, yeah, he came over in the early part of the 20th century. He was an engineer, and he came over to Saudi Arabia. And in fact, have you ever seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, he says to me. And I said, every year. I watched Lawrence of Arabia. And he says, my father rode with Lawrence in the tribe that, if you know the movie, Omar Sharif plays the tribal head. His father rode with Lawrence of Arabia. And I was just like, wow. So this whole sense, you know, I mean, it made a connection that wasn't kind of a polite religious connection, but it connected history, which I love, with movies, which I love, and suddenly, like, things started to open up. 2 days later, another option we tried and know was going to work was to have coffee at Starbucks at the Five Point Center there. And I was there. I didn't know if anybody was going to come. I saw an older woman with a trench coat, almost kind of long coat. I thought, looks like an East Coast lady, you know. So as she was coming up, I said, are you looking for the... We called the group Sons and Daughters of Abraham. So I said, are you looking for the Abraham group? And she said, yes. And her name was Sylvia Glass. So we sat down for a few minutes. I said, sounds like you might be from the East. I knew it was kind of Brooklyn or Bronx, but, you know. She goes, well, yeah, from New York. I grew up in the Bronx. And I said, oh, really? Did you ever go to any baseball games? And she said, I used to go all the time. The police used to let us in through a hole in the fence at Yankee Stadium. And I said, you saw Babe Ruth? And she goes, yeah, I saw Babe Ruth all the time. I didn't like Babe Ruth. We loved Lou Gehrig. So I'm thinking, in a week, somebody who rode, whose family rode with Lawrence of Arabia, and a woman who'd seen Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth, my life is getting good, you know? So we kept meeting, and as we made each time, and we tried different places, it got better. It got better, like any group does. We started meeting at the home of a woman named Judy Mannenberg Goldman. Some of you probably know Judy, up in the hills here, because Judy was happy to do that. And after about 4 or 5 months of just chatting and stuff, one day I thought, you know what? I said, I think we're ready for something deeper now. I just made up this game. I said, we're going to play three questions, or questions you'd always wanted to ask about another religion, but we're afraid to ask. So what we'll do is somebody from one religion asks somebody from another, and then before we come back to that religion, the other two religions need to be asked a question. First one is from Judy, and she said, looks at me and she says, what do I call you? I was like, well, Steve. She goes, no. I know you're Steve, but what do I call the kind of religious person you are? And I said, well, I guess I'm a pastor. And somebody says, well, are you a priest? I said, well, no, I'm not a priest. It's really pretty simple. I mean, Catholics are priests. What about Episcopalians? Well, yeah, I guess Episcopalians are priests. Well, are all Presbyterians pastors? Well, they kind of are. I said, but if you're from the Lutheran background, they're all pastors. Because I know anybody from the Lutheran church that would come to my church, they would always call me Pastor Steve. So that was really... Anyway, so I tried to explain, pastor, minister, reverend. And after all, I was like, this must be so hard for people to try to figure out. I had never been aware of that before. The next question is somebody asked the Jewish folks there, what do Jews believe about afterlife? And the cantor said, oh, we don't believe anything about it. People are free to believe whatever they want because there's nothing really in the Torah about it. Everybody's like, really? You know? And so this whole talk, like, gee, that's fascinating. And then Ernie Tominga, some of you know Ernie, he said, well, I've got a question for the Muslim folks. What do you believe is going to happen at the end of time? Is the one who comes back a Shia or a Sunni? And they said, in Islamic tradition, the one who comes back to judge the world at the end is Jesus Christ. And we were like, wow, what was that? And they said, oh, yeah, because Jesus was a great prophet. His mother was a prophet. Jesus is a prophet. We don't believe he's going to descend from the clouds, but he's going to live amongst people, and he's going to rise up, and when there's evil in the world, Jesus is going to defeat it. So after that, there was like anything was allowed, because that was just... But it was that sense of those three different questions. So from then on, we started meeting, and then we could go anywhere. We could ask each other anything. Towards the end of it, I thought, you know, we should have a march to finish the time. So we created a march, didn't advertise it, because I just wanted the folks that had been part of this community to really be part of it. We started at B'nai B'rith, and we had Rabbi Cohen come out and say, what's the meaning of Abraham in the Jewish tradition? We walked 4 miles down to Fairview, where my church was, and I talked about Abraham in the Christian tradition. And then we went out to Goleta, where the new mosque site's going to be, and we had a representative there talk about who Abraham is in the Islamic tradition. And then we went to Stowe Park. Somebody mentioned Seoul. Stowe Park, and we had kosher hot dog cookout, you know, that we'd all... By that time, we were close. And my wife was teaching sixth grade at Brandon School. She asked me to come in and video this class presentation. So I did, and I recognized one of her sixth graders was Dalia Khan, the daughter of Mukhtar. And the school musical was Tom Sawyer. And as it turns out, none of the sixth graders were willing to be the part of Tom Sawyer except Dalia Khan. So she came out with flannel shirt and overalls and a straw hat, and here she was delivering wonderfully all these things written by Mark Twain. And I sat there and thought, her grandfather rode with Lawrence of Arabia. She's in Goleta, in a public school in Goleta, smiling and reciting Mark Twain. I thought, this is what America is all about. This is what America, this is the vision of what America is. The friendships have continued, and what I want to end with is that this last December, in the light of all that Donald Trump has been saying, the Islamic community said, please come march with us. We want to have this theme. That's not our religion. So it was kind of quickly called together, started out there by the De La Guerra Plaza, right, I think, is where it started. And, yeah, I think so, right? And then people started marching. And after sitting at home, hearing all these debates and things, and just feeling tense, it felt so good to be walking outdoors with other people from different places. And it was a profound experience in community, and it was a profound experience in soul, and I felt like saying, take that, Donald Trump. You know? So, my own tradition, I'm part of that community, which includes service. But I think in the interfaith work that is before us at this time in history, there's things we can learn from our own tradition and from others. There's ways we can experience community. It takes time, like all good relationships. But there can be common services in which we stand up against what's evil and destructive and for what's right. And to me, that's what I aspire, the kind of wholeness of spiritual life that I think God calls us to. Okay, let's do questions. Anybody have any questions? If you're going to ask, please come to the mic. And after the group disperses, if anybody's questions aren't answered and I can help, I'll be happy to be here. So. Okay. So if we had time for the table question, I was just going to ask, where have you experienced the spiritual power of being serving or being active in the world in behalf of your spiritual ethics? Yeah.
Is the Interfaith Council, is that open to anyone who,
Sure. John, you're still part of that, right? She was asking the Interfaith Initiative of Santa Barbara, who is it open to?
Sure. It is a kind of fly-by-night board, working board, as we call ourselves. And we like to give events maybe twice a year. And our next one is the February 5th that we mentioned. We have volunteer opportunities with divisions of our faith, one called Eco-Faith, which has to do with environmental justice, and the other is Project Heal, that has to do with providing showers and shower facility, a portable shower facility for people without homes. So those are volunteer activities. But as far as board goes, no, our meetings are, not closed. You're most welcome to come, but it's boring.
There's a terrific imam in town who's spoken here. A lot of you know Yama Nyatsi. And I think just this week he started his foundation, which is called the Sacred Tree Foundation. And it's here in Santa Barbara, and it's dedicated to these kind of interfaith understanding initiatives and projects, particularly to support Muslims who are standing against ISIS and all of that, and against the racism and xenophobia politically, but in a very civilized, wonderful, cooperative way. And it's called Sacred Tree Foundation here. And Yama himself is a, well, you know, you've heard him speak. He's an amazing guy. It's an example like Lawrence of Arabia in baseball. If you've heard him speak, people are thinking, oh, it's an imam, an imam. And he said, you know, I played basketball for Santa Marcos High. And that is really confusing for people. How can an imam play for the San Marcos Royals, play? But he did. So it's the cognitive dissonance that leads to friction that helps us to go to deeper understanding. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
The imam went to Adam's school.
Did he go to Adam's school?
Yeah.
Wow.
Came in second grade.
Came in second grade. From Afghanistan, as I remember, I think. Yeah. Fabulous guy. Yes, Ginny.
Is to have the people that are comment facing the people. I just want to share, Steve mentioned community. Father Virgil was very much a community person, trying to make community. So he was at Harry's, and he said, God is at Harry's. And so Harry's put out a big sign, had a picture of Father Virgil, and it said, Father Virgil says God is at Harry's.
I think all of you that knew Father Virgil would have stories about him. Lent's coming. I was on the board at Hospice in La Casa with Father Virgil. And one time it was Lent, and I said, Father Virgil, so what are you doing for Lent? And he goes, oh, I got something I'm doing for Lent. I'm going to give up being around people I don't like. Okay, well, thank you.
Next week, we are back here at the same time. Radley Weininger will be talking about...